Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason, in the gallery for SBS World News. Europe's economic powerhouse finally has a new government. The Christian Democratic Union's Angela Merkel securing an historic fourth term as Chancellor after Social Democrats voted in favour of yet another grand coalition.
Fast 6 Monate nach dem Wahltag.
Almost 6 months after the election, voters have arrived that something happens now and that what we had intended to do is being implemented.
More on Angela Merkel in a moment. But first, here's Miles Morgan with a look back at the week that was in Canberra.
Thanks, Brett. Federal politicians returned to their electorates this week after a bruising session of Parliament last month. But politics isn't restricted to Canberra, and the government spent the week downplaying talk of a global trade war while raising talk of possible changes to Australia's migration program. The migrant intake has been in the news quite a bit lately. You'll remember in recent weeks, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott had called for it to be halved. This week, Citizenship Minister Alan Tudge spoke in Sydney about migrants and Australia's multiculturalism.
More people from more countries have come here to start a new life than almost any other nation, and we've generally been able to maintain strong social cohesion in the process.
But that cohesion, he says, isn't guaranteed.
The evidence seems to show that we're not integrating quite as well as we have done in the past, and we should be alert to this, aware of it, and adjust our policies accordingly.
Mr. Tudge spoke of enclaves emerging in Western Sydney and parts of Melbourne where English wasn't the dominant language. He claims new challenges are emerging thanks to technology and the relative ease in becoming an Australian citizen.
You can be, in essence, more easily today within a language and cultural bubble in suburban Australia than what you could in the past. I think it is time to strengthen our policies in order to lift the aspirations placed upon new migrants.
So the government says it wants to strengthen, change or improve several areas of Australia's citizenship requirements. They include English proficiency, what's termed a commitment to Australian values, and background checks. And without stating it overtly, the government's signalling it will try to revive changes to citizenship laws the Senate blocked last year. And that legislation included a pledge of allegiance to Australia and university-level English proficiency. Now, Mr. Tudge has worded the government's thinking this way.
We need to work hard at integration by stamping out any remnants of racism, but also setting higher expectations upon those who want to call Australia home.
And as well as the people coming into Australia, the government was also focusing on the steel and aluminium it sent out. And that's because United States President Donald Trump, fulfilling a campaign promise from 2016's election, announced he would impose a tariff on all steel and aluminium entering the US. The tariffs of 25 and 10% respectively caused global economic jitters and talk of a trade war. Mr. Trump says trade wars are good. The Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says they're bad.
History teaches us there are no winners in a trade war. A trade war is a race to the bottom that makes us all poorer, leaves our citizens with less choice.
On Thursday, the White House indicated there could be tariff exemptions for Mexico and Canada and possibly other countries. Now, that provides a glimmer of hope for Australia because Mr. Turnbull spent several days in Washington last month making personal pleas to President Trump to exempt Australia.
There is literally nothing to be gained in the United States at all from imposing a tariff on Australian steel exports. So we've made a very strong case and we are continuing to make it.
And that's what made news this week in federal politics.
After a tumultuous and frankly unedifying start to the year in Canberra, young Australian women could be forgiven for losing their political interest, let alone their political ambition. First, there was the Barnaby Joyce affair, then Michaelia Cash's extraordinary threat to expose rumours about staff working for the opposition leader. But as the world marked International Women's Day this week, female MPs from across the political divide united, using the platform to call for more female representation. SBS political reporter Maria Zivic spoke to some of them, including the Minister for Women, Kelly O'Dwyer.
Why do you think it's essential for there to be strong female representation in Parliament?
Look, I think it's absolutely essential that we have the vast diversity of Australia represented here, and women make up more than half of the Australian population. But I think it's absolutely critical that women, whether they be married, single, young, old, whether they have children or not have children, be represented in this place, because they bring that experience to this place when making policies and decisions that affect the lives of millions of Australians.
Do you believe that there's still, a slight feeling or, unconscious bias, perhaps, that women aren't allowed to make mistakes in their roles when they're in senior positions? Is there still that, bias there that, a man sort of makes a mistake and it goes sort of unnoticed, perhaps, in some cases, whereas it may not be the same case for women?
Look, I think it's a really interesting question, and certainly I think there is probably a higher level of scrutiny just simply because there are less women here, and as a result of that I think things stand out more when a woman does it.
Has it been worrying for you hearing some of the rhetoric around women in politics just over the last let's just take the last month, obviously the Barnaby Joyce affair, the Michaelia Cash events of last week. Has it been concerning for you some of the rhetoric around sort of the women involved in this political game?
Well, look, without focusing on any particular aspect, let me say this. I think there is no doubt that the standard in this place can be lifted, and I think that there is a real public desire for the standard to be much higher.
And more welcoming for women, who take up just 20% of Liberal Party seats in federal parliament. Quotas have helped Labor boost its numbers to 45%, but the coalition's sticking to targets instead, as explained by the Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Concetta Fierravanti-Wells.
The party is not a party of quota. I do not believe in quotas. I don't want to sit in the Senate and be referred to as a quota girl. That's not my belief. And in fact, I think that in the past where you have used quotas, it does get used against women, because there's always this dismissive attitude that, oh, you're only here because you're making up the numbers. Now, we don't need that. We don't want that. But regrettably, quotas, I think, subliminally do achieve that effect. So it's longer to go the route of targets, but in the long run, I'd rather be sitting where I am because I deserve it.
But there are a quiet few within the coalition who disagree, including Victorian Liberal MP Julia Banks.
I don't believe we can continue to address an imbalance of men and women by simply saying it will happen or it'll evolve or it'll fix itself through meritocracy. That, I think, is not the right approach.
The member for Chisholm there speaking with Maria Zivic. As parliaments all over the world work to increase female representation, the most powerful woman in the world has extended her reign, not just as the leader of Germany, but Europe too. Dr. Patricia Hogwood from the University of Westminster joins me now from London. Dr. Hogwood, hello.
Hello, Brett.
Many, even from her own party, initially doubted Angela Merkel. They mocked and ridiculed her, and they even gave her a rather misogynistic nickname. Tell us about that.
Helmut Kohl, who was, of course, the Chancellor of Unification in Germany, he brought East Germany into the existing Federal Republic of Germany back in 1990. He rather used and abused Angela Merkel as she was a young woman in the party. He referred to her as the girl, or even his girl, and he tended to use her as a bit of a gopher, gopher this, gopher that. I think part of the ridicule of Angela Merkel was she was an Easterner, and Easterners initially had a hard time in adapting to Western politics. One of Angela Merkel's particular deficits in the eyes of her more sophisticated Western peers was that she didn't dress well for the role. She didn't dress professionally according to the expectations.
Which is quite extraordinary, even at that point in time. This wasn't all that long ago.
That's right. It wasn't all that long ago. But no, fashion wasn't a big deal in the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, as it then was, East Germany. And for Angela Merkel has never felt the need, neither then or now, to validate herself in terms of the way she presents herself in her dress, in her style. You know, she famously wears this boxy long jacket in a huge array of different colours because it's much easier than choosing a different style for every time she has to make a public appearance. She's just not that interested in that aspect of life. But this led to her being rather inconspicuous in the party and, as you say, rather denigrated. And in the end, it was this inconspicuousness and this sort of aura of innocence that really helped her to make the break in German politics.
After 12 years in power and approval ratings most parliamentarians could only dream of, her nickname has changed from the girl to Mutti, or Mother. Is that meant to be an endearing reflection on her reliability and competence and frugality? I mean, this is a chancellor who doesn't even live in the official residence.
Now, most leading politicians do fall prey to some extent to the trappings of their office. They like the glitzy occasions, you know, they enjoy them. As you say, Merkel's nickname now with the public is Mum or Mummy. In the way, it's very endearing. It's a bit slightly demeaning as well, it must be said, you know, calling your Prime Minister Mum. But, you know, she would have, as you say, she would have the option of living in a very fine official residence at the Brandenburg Gate, but she prefers to stay in the small flat she's always shared with her husband. Now, this is a woman who, might be at a leading international forum. She comes home, if she's got time, she cooks her own food, she bakes. She really appeals, I think a part of the appeal to the public comes from her persona as every mum. You know, she's somebody everybody can relate to. She's a very keen football fan. I don't know if you've seen the photos of her and President Joachim Gauck celebrating in the German national squad's dressing room after their 2014 World Cup win. They look very natural and convincing. There's Angela Merkel and Gauck surrounded by sweaty footballers still in their kit and bottles of beer. You know, you cannot imagine, for example, Theresa May and the Queen in that picture. She might seem a little bit stiff and awkward in public speaking. She doesn't enjoy that at all. But when she speaks to regular people, she's fine.
This election was certainly not the coronation that Angela Merkel's supporters had hoped for and in many ways expected. It was a bit like a wake on election night in Berlin. I was at the CDU headquarters when it was announced that the party had dropped 65 seats in the Bundestag, the SPD, the main opposition, dropping 40. I had a quick word with her now outgoing Chief of Staff, Peter Altmaier, and I was asking him whether it was a mistake for Angela Merkel to declare, wir schaffen das, we can do it, in response to the refugee crisis, and whether it was going to cost them government. Here's what he told me just hours after the polls closed.
In the interest of the country, in the interest of the neighbours, and in the interest of worldwide stability. That's what we have done. And if we have suffered some losses for this purpose, I believe it was justified.
So was it a mistake for Angela Merkel to effectively open Germany's borders? And do you think she regrets saying you are welcome here to those many thousands of people?
No, I don't think she regretted it at all. We associate Angela Merkel as a very pragmatic politician. You know, one of the criticisms levelled against her is that she's too pragmatic in a way. You know, she can always find a consensus point of view. She can always mediate a conflict and come out with a resolution. So you don't always know where she's going to go. But one of the things she truly believes in are humanitarian principles, and that has been very consistent for Angela Merkel. And I think she sees the refugee crisis as not as an opportunity for her to exercise her humanitarian principles, but as a duty. You know, she truly believes that people in trouble have a right to protection. And I think Altmaier is reflecting a very deeply held belief of hers when he says that, no, we stand by that decision.
The Bundestag has changed dramatically after this election. For the first time in six decades, there is a far-right party sitting in the German federal parliament. How difficult do you think the Alternative for Germany party will make life for Angela Merkel?
They will make a lot of noise in Parliament, for sure. At 14%, and you know, with a new GroKo, a new grand coalition, ready really to be sworn in, I don't think they're going to make too much difficulty when it comes to passing legislation. Initially, it was thought that the AfD would squeeze the votes of the smaller parties, but in the event, it was the mainstream parties and the traditional parties that were squeezed. These three that actually make up the Grand Coalition now. This is why some people have dubbed this a coalition of losers, you know, because they lost most in, relatively speaking, in the campaign, in the voting outcome. I think all of the parties expected the AfD on this occasion to enter the federal parliament. This is something that many people had hoped never to see, but it's quite in line with developments in other European countries. In fact, Germany is one of the last to see a presence of a far-right party in the parliament. All of the parties saw them as an uncoalitionable. You know, they would never consider forging a coalition government with the AfD. As long as a party is considered uncoalitionable, it is very difficult for it to have a real impact on the work of government during the parliamentary session. I think she still is in control, very much in control within the CDU. This will be her last period in office, but she will decide how and when she goes.
And when do you think that will be?
I think that will probably be during this coming parliamentary session. But it depends really very much on international developments. There's a couple of German commentators have said that Angela Merkel isn't in this for vanity. She thinks that she is best placed to make a real contribution to Germany and the world by keeping hold of this role. I don't know how true that is because I haven't had the benefit of being in her inner circle. But if this is the case, she will make a decision on when she thinks it is safest for her to step down.
And how dramatic will the change be, not just for Germany, but for Europe too, when we see an end of Angela Merkel's reign?
This will be a very dramatic change in Europe. Europe owes its stability over the last 5 years, certainly, to interventions by Angela Merkel. Behind the scenes of the European institutions, there's a leading club of key member states. In the past, it has been France, Germany, UK, sometimes including Spain, if, for example, internal security is on the agenda, sometimes including one or two other countries when other important issues are on the agenda. But mostly it's been the three. Now, of course, the UK is out of it because of Brexit. The Franco-German alliance is once again the driver of developments in European politics. Angela Merkel has been very frustrated about the way the coalition negotiations have dragged on because it's meant that she hasn't been an active participant in European politics as she would have been over the last 5 years or so. This has allowed Emmanuel Macron to establish a little bit of a power base. You know, we see a shift in this Franco-German relationship towards France. But when Angela Merkel goes, irrespective of what happens with that relationship, which many rightly call the motor of the European Union and European integration, they will lose a very, very competent mediator for issues within and external to the European Union. And the particular danger points I would see are in communicating with Russia. Now, Angela Merkel, having grown up in East Germany, speaks fluent Russian and has been the point of contact for the European Union with Russia, and in dealings with Turkey, in which she's very, very much practiced. These are the two areas which any other candidate would find very, very difficult to fulfil.
And what do you think her legacy will be for aspiring female politicians?
I think she's done one very special thing for young women in Germany, in that she's taken on the challenge of Chancellor completely on her own terms. She is her own woman, taking on this national and international role entirely on her own terms will set a very good example to other women who would like to play a top role in politics.
Dr. Patricia Hogwood from the University of Westminster, thank you very much.
Thank you.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.